at VOA One The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Smoke from wildfires burning in the western United States has changed the taste of grapes in some of the country's most celebrated vineyards. It has given the fruits a taste that could mean disaster for the 2020 harvest season. Wineries in California, Oregon, and Washington have survived wildfires before. But the smoke from the fires this year has been especially bad. It has been thick enough to cover whole vineyards. Day after day, some West Coast cities had some of the worst air quality in the world. No one yet knows the severity of the smoke damage to the crop, but growers are trying to study it. If these grapes are made into wine without steps to limit the harm, the taste could be so bad that the product cannot be marketed. The wildfires will likely be, without question, the single worst disaster the wine grape growing community has ever faced, said John Aguirre. He is president of the California Association of Wine Grape Growers. Winemakers around the world are already adapting to climate change. That includes higher temperatures and longer periods with little or no rainfall. Vineyards near some forests face an added risk. The smoke from wildfires could ruin everything. Unfortunately, climate experts are telling us this is going to be a problem, said Anita Oberholster, a wine expert at the University of California, Davis. And so we need to do better. We need to do loads more research. West Coast vineyards have already begun harvesting their crops. Yet some wineries are not taking grapes they had agreed to buy unless they have been tested for smoke damage, Aguirre said. Even worse, laboratories are too busy to test new orders in time. ETS Laboratories has offices in the Napa Valley town of St. Helena, California. The lab says test results on grape samples that it gets now will not be ready until November. Any samples after that will have to wait even longer, the lab's website says. Noah Dorrance owns Reeve Wines in Healdsburg, California. He talked to the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper about this year's crop. In every grape he has tried, he said, you could already taste and smell this ashy, barbecued taste. It is similar to food cooked over a campfire, he said. John Aguirre remembered trying the smoke-damaged wine during a tasting event. He read a comment that someone had written on a piece of paper. It compared the flavor to fecal plastic. I tasted it and I went, "Oh my God," Aguirre said. The issue comes from chemical compounds called volatile phenols. Those chemicals are naturally present in grapes, but burning wood releases them, and grapes can take in volatile phenols, Oberholster explained. When their levels get too high, it can make grapes taste unpleasant. Australian researchers were the first to identify the risks. In 2003, they linked smoke in the atmosphere to a strange taste in wine, said Mark Christick. He is managing director of the Australian Wine Research Institute. From then until 2015, Australian producers lost more than $286 million in grapes and wine profits as a result of smoke. The problems continue. Australia's most recent fire season was horrific, Christick said. Fires were burning along Australia's eastern coast, and the smoke reached across crops from many vineyards, he said. In the forested hills near Oregon's Willamette Valley, fire covered the area with thick yellow-black smoke. The area is famous for its cool climate, Pinot Noir grapes and wines. Jim Bernau is founder of Willamette Valley Vineyards. He said that in 38 years, he has never experienced or seen anything like this as a wine grower. By last weekend, rain and changing winds had cleared the skies in Oregon. Bernau believed many Oregon wineries would escape damage because the smoke did not stay too long in the area. His winery has been fermenting small samples to test whether smoke affects the resulting wine. After just about 2 days, the results showed a low risk of smoke damage for the white and rosé wines. But for those, the skin is removed. In fermenting red samples, the skin stays on. The first results are also hopeful. But the winery is ready to turn some of the grapes with heavier smoke damage into rosé instead of red wine, said Christine Clare. She is winery director at Willamette Valley Vineyards. This month, Aguirre's group and 9 other industry organizations asked the U.S. Congress for disaster aid. They said without it, their members will face economic unknowns at a level never before seen. The wine industry had already suffered this year because of the coronavirus health crisis. Eateries, wine tasting rooms, and other places had been shut down as a result. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. In March 2020, in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, many people began living under stay-at-home orders. In some areas, restaurants and bars were forced to close or had limited services. These measures were meant to help slow the spread of COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. During those early pandemic days, something else happened. Online sales of alcoholic drinks rose sharply. In the United States, online alcohol sales were up 234% compared to the same period a year ago. That information comes from the research company Nielsen. Victor Karpiuk is a doctor and expert on drug addiction at the Mayo Clinic in the U.S. state of Minnesota. He says people have long turned to alcohol to reduce stress and forget about their problems. But he warns about overusing alcohol in difficult times. This, he says, can lead to bad results. His comments appear on the Mayo Clinic's website. Dr. Karpiuk noted that during the pandemic, light alcohol use can easily become problematic. He said that if you have 3 or 4 drinks today, and then 3 or 4 more tomorrow, you can quickly hit the limit of what is considered moderate. But what is that limit? How much alcohol is considered moderate? The U.S. National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism defines moderate drinking this way: up to 1 drink a day for a woman and up to 2 drinks a day for a man. A drink is defined as 6/10 of a fluid ounce, or almost 18 milliliters of pure alcohol. However, the NIH dietary guidelines do not recommend that people who do not drink alcohol start drinking for any reason. Dr. Karpiuk said that an increase in drinking or a pattern of drinking may be a sign of alcohol abuse and development of addiction. Alcohol addiction, he added, can affect relationships as well as the body, the whole body. There is no organ or system, he said, which is not impacted by chronic and significant alcohol use. Alcohol-related liver disease is perhaps the most commonly reported problem, but the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism warns that there are others. Studies have shown that 1 drink a day increases the risk of breast cancer in women. Research has also shown that alcohol misuse increases the risk of heart disease and some forms of cancer. Dr. Karpiuk, a psychiatrist, added that there is a lot of negative impact that long-term significant alcohol use has on brain tissue. Addiction experts at the NIH say it is safest to avoid alcohol completely if you are taking medications that mix badly with alcohol, trying to control a medical condition that can be made worse by drinking, under the legal age for drinking alcohol, planning to drive a vehicle or operate machinery, doing activities that require skill and coordination, recovering from alcohol use disorder or unable to control the amount you drink, pregnant or trying to become pregnant. If you find yourself drinking alcohol at the end of a long, stressful day, you are probably not alone. However, health experts suggest exploring other ways to reduce stress. Call a friend, take a walk, do something you enjoy, such as watching a movie, reading a book, or listening to music. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From V VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Jackson took office in 1829. He was popular with many voters. They saw him as the symbol of the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his vice president, John C. Calhoun. As his presidency went on, another struggle began. This time, it was Jackson against the Bank of the United States. The first Bank of the United States had closed in 1811. But without a central bank, the country's finances had suffered during the War of 1812. So in 1816, Congress provided money to establish the Second Bank of the United States. The bank could provide loans, pay bills, collect taxes, and move money around the country. Congress gave the bank a charter to do business for 20 years. The government owned one-fifth of the bank. A small group of private citizens owned the rest. Lawmakers gave the bank enormous power. The Bank of the United States had $35 million in capital. Some of that money came from the government. Most came from investors. Historian Bray Hammond notes that at the time, the Bank of the United States was the richest corporation in the world. The Bank of the United States also printed the country's paper money, and it was the only bank permitted to have offices across the nation. By making it easy or difficult for businesses to borrow money, the bank's owners could control the economy in almost any part of the United States.
What this means is that you are granting, and Congress did grant, exclusive privileges to the Bank of the United States, which meant exclusive money-making opportunities to its stockholders.
Historian Daniel Feller explains that the Bank of the United States helped the government to do its business effectively and efficiently. But it also helped the people who owned stock in the bank. During Jackson's presidency, a man named Nicholas Biddle led the Bank of the United States. Biddle was an extremely intelligent man. He had completed his studies at the University of Pennsylvania when he was only 13 years old. When he was 18, he was sent to Paris as secretary to the American minister. During America's war with Britain in 1812, Biddle helped establish the Bank of the United States. He became its president when he was only 37 years old. Biddle clearly understood his power as president of the Bank of the United States. In his mind, the government had no right to interfere in any way with the bank's business. President Jackson did not agree, nor was he very friendly toward the bank. Not many people from Western states were. They did not trust the bank's paper money. They wanted to deal in gold and silver. Jackson criticized the bank in each of his yearly messages to Congress. He said the Bank of the United States was dangerous to the liberty of the people. He said the bank could build up or pull down political parties through loans to politicians. Jackson opposed giving the bank a new charter. He proposed that a new bank be formed as part of the Treasury Department. The president urged Congress to consider the future of the bank long before the bank's charter was to end in 1836. Then, if the charter was rejected, the bank could close its business slowly over several years. Changing the banking system slowly, Jackson said, would prevent serious economic problems for the country. But the bank's president wanted to renew the charter early. He made the request in January 1832, 9 months before the next presidential election. Jackson's opponent, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky, was sure that the issue of the bank could win him some votes. Clay argued his case on the floor of the Senate for 3 days. He strongly urged the Senate to renew the bank's charter. He said the country was in the middle of a revolution, not yet a bloody revolution, but things were happening that pointed to a total change of the pure Republican character of the government. Power was being centered in the hands of one man, he said. He meant President Jackson. Clay added that if Congress did not act, the government would fail. Clay then asked the Senate to condemn Jackson, saying he violated the Constitution and the nation's laws. The Senate approved the resolution. The chief opponent to the bank was Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. He objected to the renewal of the charter, he told the Senate, because the bank was too great and powerful and made the rich richer and the poor poorer. The Senate finally voted on the bank's new charter. The vote was 28 for renewal and 20 against. The House voted 3 weeks later. It also approved the charter, 107-85. The lawmakers sent the bill to the White House. President Jackson debated it with members of his cabinet. Some wanted to negotiate a compromise, but Jackson decided to veto the bill in the strongest possible language. On July 10, 1832, Jackson sent a message to Congress explaining his reasoning. Jackson said he did not believe the bank's charter was constitutional. Jackson also spoke of the way the bank moved money from west to east. He said the bank was owned by a small group of rich men, mostly in the east. Some of the owners, he said, were foreigners. Much of the bank's business was done in the west. The money paid by Westerners for loans went into the pockets of the Eastern bankers. Jackson said this was wrong. Then the president spoke of his firm belief in the rights of the common man. It is to be regretted, he said, that the rich and powerful bend the acts of the government to their own purposes. Jackson said that instead, the government should shower its favors, as heaven does its rain, on the high and low alike, on the rich and the poor equally. Jackson's veto of the bank bill may have cost him votes among the wealthy, but it earned him votes among the common people, like farmers and laborers. He easily won re-election in November of 1832. Martin Van Buren became his vice president. Historian Daniel Feller says Jackson believed his victory meant that Americans supported his policies, including the bank veto.
he had a very popular personal image. It's possible he would have been reelected by the same margin or larger anyway. The one thing we can say looking forward is that when later on you had somebody carrying on Jackson's policies absolutely faithfully without Jackson's personal charisma, he proved to be not nearly so popular.
In his second term, Jackson stopped putting federal money into the Bank of the United States. Instead, he put the money into state banks. The bank president, Nicholas Biddle, fought with all his power to keep the bank open. He demanded that borrowers immediately repay their loans. Businesses struggled without the bank's assistance. Workers lost their jobs. Biddle blamed President Jackson for the financial panic. Critics of Jackson's bank policy called him King Andrew I. But as time passed, business people began to see that the Bank of the United States was being much tighter in its money policy than was necessary. They began to feel that it was the bank's president, not Jackson, who was responsible for the serious economic situation in the country. Biddle took no responsibility for the financial crisis. He then made a very bad decision. Biddle asked the governor of Pennsylvania to make a speech supporting the bank. At the same time, Biddle refused to lend the state of Pennsylvania $300,000. The governor was furious. Instead of making a speech supporting the bank, he made one that sharply criticized it. 2 days later, the governor of New York proposed that the state sell $4 or $5 million of stock for loans to help state banks. The New York legislature approved selling even more. Strengthening state banks helped break the power of the Bank of the United States. Nicholas Biddle began to see that the battle was lost. He started making more loans to businesses. The economic panic slowly ended. Jackson's victory over the Bank of the United States was clear. Biddle started to lose the support of many members of Congress. In the House of Representatives, James Polk proposed 4 resolutions about the bank. One said the bank should not get a new charter in 1836. The second resolution said government money should not be deposited in the bank. The third said the government should continue to put its money in state banks. And the fourth proposed an investigation of the bank and the reasons for the economic panic in the country. All 4 of these anti-bank resolutions were approved. One of Biddle's aides described the feelings of bank officials. "This day," he said, "should be ripped from the history of the Republic." He said, "The President of the United States had seized the public treasury, and the representatives of the people had approved it." Jackson won what he himself considered a glorious triumph. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.